Chapter 66. Tara Grayson had just paid a fortune to one of the prettiest men she'd ever seen. Jarl said he spoke for the Shinga, but he carried himself with such assurance, she wondered if he might not be the Shinga himself. She hadn't liked handing over so much money to the Sakage, but she hadn't had any choice. The God King's army would arrive with the dawn, and she'd already spent too long in the city. The coup had not gone according to the God King's plan. The Caladorans controlled the bridges, the castle, and the city's gates. But some of them had only skeleton crews. That would change when the rest of the army arrived, and Tara Grayson and her nobles needed to be gone when that happened. If she hadn't paid half her fortune to Jarl, she would have had to leave behind all of it. A queen made the hard decisions, and with everyone else dead, a queen was what she was now. It was midnight. The wagons were packed. The men were waiting. It was time. Tara stood outside her family's mansion. Like the other ducal family's homes, theirs was old, a veritable fortress. A looted fortress now. A looted fortress smelling of the barrels and barrels of oil they had poured in every room, over the precious heirlooms too heavy to carry, and into the grooves they'd cut in every centuries-old beam. It was time. Jarl's wet boys were supposed to slaughter the Caladorans holding the city's east gate at midnight. All the other nobles were huddled outside their own houses. From her elevated front porch, she could see some of them up and down Horax Street, waiting to see if she'd really do it. She locked the mansion in her mind. After she returned, she would rebuild this for her family, twice as splendid as before. Tara Grayson walked to the street and took the torch from Sergeant Gamble. The archers gathered around her. She personally lit every arrow. At her nod, they loosed them. The mansion went up in flame. Fire poured from the windows and reached for the heavens. Queen Tara Grayson didn't look. She mounted her horse and led her column, her pathetic army of 300 soldiers and twice as many servants and shopkeepers, into the street toward the east gate. Across the east side, the great houses lit up one by one. They were the funeral pyres of fortunes. Not only were the nobles losing everything, but so too were all those who depended on them for their employment. But the fires of destruction were also beacons of hope. You may have won, Scenario was saying, but your victory is no triumph. You can force me from my home, but you will not live in it. I will leave you nothing but scorched earth. In response to those great fires across the city, smaller fires rose too. Shopkeepers set fire to their shops. Blacksmiths stoked their furnaces so hot they would crack. Bakers destroyed their ovens. Millers sank their millstones in the plith. Warehouse owners set fire to their storehouses. Livestock owners slaughtered their herds. Captains, confined to the plith by witches' magic, scuttled their own ships. Thousands joined the exodus. The trickle of nobles and their servants became a flood. The flood became a host, an army marching out of the city, marching in defeat, but marching. Some drove wagons, some rode. Some walked barefoot with empty hands and empty bellies. Some cursed, some prayed. Some stared over their shoulders with haunted eyes. Some wept. Some left brothers and sisters and parents and children, but every one of Scenaria's orphaned sons and daughters carried a small, dim hope in their hearts. I shall return, it vowed. I shall return. Neff stood as far to one side as he could among the maesters, generals, and soldiers, waiting to greet God King Gareth or Sul as he rode across West Kingsbridge with his retinue. The God King wore a great ermine cloak that accentuated the paleness of his northern skin. His chest was bare aside from the heavy gold chains of his office. He was robust, thick-bodied but muscular, vigorous for his age. The God King pulled his stallion to a halt before the courtyard gate. 6 heads on pikes greeted him. A 7th pike stood empty.
"Commander Gare!"
"Yes, my liege, my god, your highness, sire."
The former royal guard cleared his throat. Things were not good. Though Roth's and Neff's plans had seemed to go without a problem, somehow the God King's armies had sustained far heavier losses than they'd planned. A boatload of Highlanders dead, many of the nobles who ought to be dead escaped, great swathes of the city aflame, the heart of Scenaria's industry and economy reduced to ashes. There was no resistance yet, but with so many nobles still alive, it would come. The Maesters that were supposed to have been a devastating spearhead into the heart of Modai were now dead. More than 50 Maesters dead at a stroke without any explanation except rumors of some mage with more talent than anyone else since Ezra the Mad and Jorsan Alcestis. The Siurin invasion ended before it began. The God King's son murdered just as he completed his Urtan. The Sakage would have to be brought to heel. Fires, literal and figurative, would have to be put out. Someone would have to answer for it. Neff Dada was trying to figure out how to make sure it wasn't him.
"Why is there an empty pike on my bridge?"
the God King asked.
"Anyone?"
Commander Hurin Gare shifted in his saddle, stupidly looking at the empty pike.
"We haven't found Prince's, I mean, the Pretender's, Logan Gyre's body yet, sire. We do know that he's dead. We have 3 reports confirming his death, but in all the fighting, we're working on it."
"Indeed."
God King Ursul didn't look at Hurin Gare. He was studying the faces of the royal family above him.
"And this shadow that killed my son? He's dead too?"
Neff felt a chill at the quiet menace in the God King's query. When the Caladorans had first gone into the throne room, they thought some elite unit must have wiped out all the Caladorans in the room, but Neff had been able to revive a man who'd had his feet cut off. He swore he'd seen most of the fight before he passed out. It was one man. A shadow. The Night Angel, he called him. The story was already getting out among the men. A man who walked unseen, who could kill 30 Highlanders and 5 Maesters and 1 of the God King's own Ethlings. A man impervious to steel and to magic. It was nonsense, of course. With all the blood they'd found, the man must be dead. But without a body.
"Someone dragged his body away, sir. We followed the blood trail through the hidden passages. It was a lot of blood, sire. If it really was just one man, he's dead."
"It seems we have a lot of dead people without bodies, Commander. Find them. In the meantime, put up another head. Preferably one that looks like Logan Gyre's."
It wasn't fair. Feral Caelius had been among the first Highlanders on Scenarian soil. He'd been one of the few to get off the burning, sinking barge, and that only because he'd had the wits to throw off his armor before jumping in. So he didn't drown like so many others had. He'd joined another unit and fought barehanded until he could arm himself from the Highlanders who died in the first assault on the courtyard. He'd personally killed 6 Scenarian soldiers and 2 nobles, 6 nobles if you counted children, which he didn't. And what had he been given to recognize his heroism, his cunning? The shit duty. Certain units were being given looting privileges. The good units on the west side, what the barbarians called the Warrens, and the best units looting the remains of the east side with the officers. Farrell's unit was all dead, so he got assigned with clearing the rubble on the east bridge. It wasn't only dirty, it was dangerous. The witches had extinguished the fire, but many of the planks were weak, some of them cracking or breaking if you stood on them. The pilings were fine, sheathed in iron. They were impervious to fire. But you couldn't stand on the pilings, so a fat lot of good that did. The worst part of the job was the bodies. Some of them were like seared steak, crusted black on the outside and cracked and oozing on the inside, and the stench of burnt flesh and burnt hair. He was picking through the bodies, taking whatever looked promising and dumping the bodies over the side of the bridge. Some of the units would be glad to have their dead back for proper burial, but Farrell wasn't going to carry the damned stinking things across this bridge. To the abyss with them. Then he saw a sword. It must have been under one of the bodies when the fire had started, because it was untouched. There wasn't even smoke damage on the hilt. It was a beautiful blade, the hilt carved with dragons. It was the kind of sword that befitted the leader of a warband, or a warlord. With such a sword, Farrell's clan would hold him in awe he deserved. He was supposed to bring anything unusual he found to one of the Verdmeisters. Sure, after how well they've treated me. Looking at the other men working on the bridge and seeing that none were watching, he drew his sword, set it aside, and slid his prize into its sheath. Not a perfect fit, but good enough for the moment. The hilt was a problem. What with those dragons? But he'd wrap leather bindings around it soon enough. He was good with his hands. Give him a few hours and this sword would look like any other. The sword brightened his outlook considerably. It wasn't really enough to repay his valor, but it was a start. The Meister walked down the last corridor to what the southern barbarians called Hell's Asshole. The nauseating, intoxicating wash of torment engulfed her. She missed a step and stumbled against the wall. The soldier accompanying her turned. He looked scared. "It's nothing," she said. She walked to the grate covering the hole. A few words and red light burned in front of her. The creatures in the hole squinted and shrank back. She spoke again, and the light descended into the hole. She examined each prisoner. 10 men, 1 woman, and 1 simpleton with filed teeth. None of them could be the usurper. She turned, slightly dizzy, and walked out, trying not to flee. A minute later, a big man rolled out from an overhang carved in the stone. The woman looked at him and shook her head.
"You're a fool. Nothing they could do to you would be as bad as staying here. Look at you. You're soft. The hole will break you."
13. Logan stared at her flatly. A grimy woman with gaping holes in her dress, short a few teeth. The look on her face was the only thing approaching human kindness that was to be found in this hole.
"Though all the detritus of humanity pass through this hole, and all the fires of perdition rise from it, I will not be broken," Logan said.
"He uses a lot of big words, don't he?"
the big man named Finn said. He smiled a smile full of bloody gums, one of the first symptoms of scurvy, and wrapped his sinew rope back around his body.
"Lot of meat on that big fucker. We'll eat real good."
Scurvy meant food deficiencies. Food deficiencies meant Finn had lived long enough to get sick from food deficiencies. Finn was a survivor. Logan turned his eyes to him and pulled out his knife. Literally, his only edge against these animals.
"Let me make this real simple," he said,
having to stifle the impulse to say "really" instead of "real."
"You will not break me. The hole will not break me.
I will not break. I will not be broken.
What's your name, love?
The woman asked.
Logan found himself grinning. Something fierce and primal was rising inside him. Something inside him said, "Where others have failed, have faltered, have fallen, I will be triumphant. I am different. I am cut of a new cloth. I will rise.
Call me King," he said,
and he smiled a fuck you through the angst and the sorrow. And he was potent. That was it. That was survival. That was the secret. That was the living flame hidden in the ashes of his burned-out heart. If only he could hold it.